This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Khamenei says the U.S. and some European countries were overly involved in the recent riots in Iran. Palestinian health workers in the Gaza Strip stage a protest against Israeli restrictions on the import of medical equipment. And the U.S. president declares an emergency state in California after severe storms kill at least 12 people. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the U.S. and Europe were overtly involved in the recent riots in the country. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei says Iran's enemies mainly push their agenda using cyberspace and other media outlets as propaganda tools. He said the media hype was aimed at creating the impression of public discontent with economic problems and shortcomings in other sectors. The leader noted, however, that they did not want weaknesses to go away. The aim, he said, was rather eliminating the country's strong points. Ayatollah Khamenei underlined that what the rioters did amounted to treason. He pointed to the recently released documents of about the order by the U.S. President Jimmy Carter to topple the Islamic Republic just 10 months after its inception in 1979. Ayatollah Khamenei said the U.S. used every means at its disposal, including propaganda, to achieve its goal. Academic and political analyst Fadi Zadi tells us how Iran has not only survived but also thrived in the face of U.S. sanctions.
Iran has been advancing in the last 43 years since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Iran's military is quite capable of defending itself with indigenous technology. Iran's young population is educated. We are advancing in a number of scientific fields, and the security in the country is also an example for the part of the world that we live in. So overall, with all the pressures and sanctions and the difficulties that the country has been facing, Iran has been able to survive and advance, and that is significant, and this is something that countries like the United States or the Zionists in occupied Palestine don't like to see. And this type of hybrid warfare against Iran is basically designed to weaken Iran's strengths, and that's what we have been witnessing in the last number of months.
Cousins have been driving a convoy of ambulances along the border fence with the Israeli-occupied territories to protest the regime's import restrictions on medical equipment. A banner on the ambulance read, "Preventing the entry of medical devices means the slow death of Gaza's patients." Gaza's health ministry has warned that the Israeli blockade on medical machines put patients' lives at risk. The ministry said current equipment is in bad shape and, quote, crumbling. The protest was staged after Israel refused to allow entry of X-ray machines needed to treat patients in the Gaza Strip. The Israeli imposed a tight blockade on Gaza Strip in 2007. Earlier, our Gaza correspondent Hashef Shannon told us what Gaza's health workers are hoping to achieve.
The medical personnel hope that their action would attract or draw the attention of the international community, and even the attention of some people inside the Israeli regime. And that's the reason why the Ministry of Health decided to hang banners over the ambulances in three languages, in English, Arabic, and in Hebrew, trying to draw the attention of the international community and also international organizations about the plight of Palestinian patients in the besieged Gaza Strip. We have to remember that Israel imposed a crippling and hermetic blockade on the Gaza Strip since 2007, and the restrictions literally began in 2006 following Hamas's overwhelming victory in Palestinian legislative elections throughout Palestine. Since 2007, over 1,100 Palestinian patients in Gaza died because of Israeli restrictions.
In the U.S., the state of California, a severe storm has claimed the lives of 12 people. More than 120,000 homes and businesses remain without power 10 days after the storm struck. It has also disrupted road travel with flash floods and rock slides. Forecasters warn that the northern and central California regions are prone to the impact of the cyclones. The conditions are not likely to improve before midweek. U.S. President Joe Biden has declared a state of emergency in the region. Over 7,000 nurses in New York have staged a strike in protest at harsh working conditions and staffing policies. Striking nurses rallied outside the hospitals in Bronx and Manhattan. They waved signs in support of hiring more nurses and better pay. The walkouts forced the centers to move patients and scale back other services. The strike came after authorities failed to reach an agreement with the nurses' representatives. The COVID pandemic has exacerbated the nursing shortage in the U.S. Many nurses have left long-standing jobs for higher-paying terms. Earlier, we're joined by our U.S. correspondent Colin Campbell for more details of the strikes.
Well, the strike was organized by the New York State Nurses Association. This is a group of nurses that have come together that advocate their own interests. And what nurses are saying is that they are stressed out, quite frankly. They are overworked and they are tired. So approximately 7,000 nurses went on strike in New York, and they called to the attention for some of the subpar conditions in which they've been forced to work in. What does that include? Well, you have nurses that are caring for several infants at a time, when usually it's regulated that when a baby is born, they are paired up with a nurse, meaning one-to-one, very specialized care. Well, now nurses are saying that they have to attend to 3 to 4 babies at a time. This could mean administering medication, making sure that they're calmed down, making sure their diapers are changed. And as you can imagine, these nurses are working overtime or working much more than they should be working. And they also say that because of the lack of nurses that some New York area hospitals have failed to hire, they are working even more when it comes to emergency room situations. And that could mean subpar care for patients. Instead of someone coming in and getting attentive care right away, they may be delayed. or maybe a patient who's already been admitted may have delayed medication coming to them because that nurse is busy attending to someone else. So what they're saying is they need more nurses. They want hospitals in the area to hire more people and to make pay more competitive so more nurses will be attracted to those jobs, and that their jobs, the nurses who are already there, their jobs will be a bit easier and they can do them with a bit more quality.
The Brazilian communications minister says the attacks on the country's Congress, Supreme Court, and presidential palace are more severe than the U.S. Capitol riots in 2021. Paulo Pimenta says that what happened in Washington was an invasion of the building, a legislative branch. However, in Brasilia, there was an invasion of the seat of the branches of government. Two of Brazil's neighboring countries have joined the chorus of global condemnations of the riots. Chilean President Gabriel Boric labeled it unacceptable. He called for an extraordinary meeting of the Organization of American States. His Colombian counterpart, Gustavo Petro, also slammed the riots and linked them to the 1973 Chilean coup. Camila Escalante, our correspondent, is standing by to give us the latest. Okay, what's up, Camila? Do you have any latest developments to share with us?
Well, as in the last transmission, I'm in Sao Paulo in the center of the city. And just a bit ago, a very large march of tens of thousands of people went by here from the social movements, the unions, many communities, students, graduate students, all sorts of groups of people. It was absolutely massive. And of course, they are out here as well as in other state capitals and small towns around the country today to repudiate what took place yesterday. They call it a fascist coup attempt. They call those who perpetrated the acts in Brasilia terrorists. And they say they want these people to be held accountable immediately. They expect immediate investigations to roll out, which did start immediately yesterday, as announced by Lula and his administration. They are looking into the financiers of who provided material support for these actions, including who paid for the buses. A very important question, who provided the transportation and all sorts of other financial support required to maintain these protest camps that we've seen for weeks and weeks since the October 30th election, in which Lula da Silva was victorious and in which their candidate and their leader, Jair Bolsonaro, lost. Bolsonaro, of course, has fled justice on a tip from his advisors who said that if he stayed in Brazil, he would be brought to justice most likely. He would have to face many of the charges and investigations against him. So he's been in southern Florida for the past week and a half. Of course, he didn't participate in the inauguration that took place on January 1st. There's a little bit of police activity here, of course, because the protests, the mass mobilization took place, and there are, of course, some groups here in Sao Paulo that are opposed to the people who are mobilizing, who they characterize as petistas, as lulistas, people who support the Workers' Party and Lula da Silva. So there has been a little bit of tension in the streets today.
Thank you very much for that update, Camila Escalante, our correspondent from Sao Paulo. The UK's National Health Service is facing a serious crisis as a meeting between unions and ministers fails to resolve the dispute over pay. After the meeting, the United Trade Union negotiator said that the talks with the government missed the opportunity. He accused the ministers of focusing on productivity instead of pay, which he said was an insult to his members. The meeting comes as the UK is witnessing an unprecedented strike by health workers, including nurses, paramedics, and ambulance drivers. They are demanding higher pay in line with soaring inflation in the country. Britain has faced a wave of industrial actions over the last few months, with strikes crippling various sectors, including transportation. Our London correspondent Saeed Pereza joined us earlier to tell us more about the meeting between unions and British government ministers.
The government is intransigent and it refuses to meet the demands of the different industries who have been asking through their unions for a pay rise that is in keeping with the rising inflation, which is in the double digits. We heard, as you said earlier, from Une Kassab, who is the negotiator representing the Unite Union that represents ambulance drivers. Apart from everything else, he said, he also added that he was very disappointed, but not surprised. They went in there with good faith to meet the ministers, hoping to find common ground, and that didn't come about. Some other unions, of course, they said that there were some progress, but that there was no real tangible commitment on the part of the government. And what that means that Britain is now bracing itself for more public sector action in the coming weeks and beyond, with no end in sight in government, with no signs, rather, of the government giving in to their demands. Big numbers have been totted up of the impact that these strikes will have on the economy, on the hospitality sector, for example, but there is real concern about the health sector. Ambulance drivers, nurses, other workers working in the industry going on strike, and the impact that will have on the way hospitals in the long run, whether or not these hospitals will be able to cope. The NHS, the National Health Service, in the minds of many, already on the brink of collapse.
Russia has slammed France and other Western states for their recent decision to ramp up military support for Kiev, warning that such measures only deepens the suffering of Ukrainians. The Kremlin spokesman said, he reiterated actually, that Western arms deliveries cannot and will not change anything on the ground. Dmitry Peskov says such moves would not deter Russia from achieving its goals either. Last week, France and Germany announced that they would send light combat vehicles, including tanks, to Kiev to help it fight Russia. Ukraine, which has scored the battlefield success in successors recent months, has asked its Western backers for heavier weapons. Moscow, however, has time and again warned that Western leaders are prolonging the conflict by providing weapons to Ukraine. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. After the defeat of Takfiri terrorists supported by the United States and its allies in Syria, Western countries are always seeking to create unrest in Damascus. One of the cases that the West hypocritically pursues during United Nations sessions is the case of the use of chemical weapons against civilians in Syria, which the Syrian authorities have consistently rejected and blamed Western-backed terrorist groups for these heinous crimes. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The website, The Cradle, has covered this story and tells us more. The United Arab Emirates ambassador and permanent representative to the United Nations has deplored attempts by certain states to politicize the Syrian chemical weapons file, stating that all parties must adhere to the fundamental principles of the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW. Lana Zaki Noseiba made the remarks at a Security Council session on the situation of chemical weapons in Syria on Friday, 6 of January 2023, stating that the issue has turned out to be one of the most politicized files of the United Nations organ. She highlighted that all sides must respect the OPCW's basic principles, including consensus and avoiding politicization. Lana Zaki Noseiba said, "On 13th of January 1993, then UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali opened the Chemical Weapons Convention for signature in Paris, and 130 countries signed the treaty. This is proof of the international consensus about the accord, and the treaty is viewed as one of the most important historical achievements in the field of disarmament." She pointed out, nevertheless, the Syrian chemical weapons file is one of the Council's most politicized files. Noseiba highlighted, "The United Arab Emirates has repeatedly condemned the use of chemical weapons in any place and at any time, by anyone and under any circumstances, because the use of such munitions is a blatant violation of the Chemical Weapons Convention provisions and international principles." The top UAE diplomat pointed to the remarkable progress on the path of resolving the Syrian chemical weapons issue, calling on all parties involved to have a constructive dialogue. On 14th of April 2018, the United States, Britain and France carried out a string of airstrikes against Syria over a suspected chemical weapons attack on the city of Douma, located about 10 kilometers northeast of Syria's capital, Damascus. That alleged attack was reported by the White Helmets Group, which published videos showing them purportedly treating survivors. Leaked Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons documents later showed that the investigators of the Douma incident had found no evidence of a chemical weapons attack. However, the organization censored the findings under pressure from the United States and its allies to conceal evidence undermining the pretext of the US-led bombing campaign of Syria just days after the alleged attack. The Western media and Western governments have repeatedly accused the Syrian government of using chemical weapons against its own citizens. It comes as Syria surrendered its stockpile of chemical weapons back in 2014 to a joint mission led by the United States and the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW, which oversaw the destruction of the weaponry. It has also consistently denied using chemical weapons. TV's website has also covered the same story and tells us more. Syria's Deputy Permanent Representative to the United Nations has called on the UN Security Council to change its approach vis-à-vis his country's chemical file and deal with the related developments objectively and preserve its technical nature by standing away from any politicization. Speaking at a recent United Nations Security Council meeting on the situation in West Asia, in New York, Al-Hakam Dandi said Syria has voluntarily acceded to the Chemical Weapons Convention, the CWC, destroyed all of its stockpiles of chemical weapons and their production facilities, and agreed to extend the tripartite agreement for 6 months. Al-Hakam al-Dandi argued that certain Western countries insist on flouting the Security Council's resources and time instead of discussing pressing issues about maintaining international peace and security and upholding the goals and principles of the Charter of the United Nations. Dandi dismissed accusations leveled by certain Western countries against Syria, saying such false claims are rooted in unprofessional and non-objective reports that come out as a result of political pressure being exerted on the Technical Secretariat of the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW, and its various teams. He noted Syria also renews its demand on the OPCW to rectify its course of action and stay clear of any politicization, which has dominated its activities for many years. Dandi reiterated Syria's categorical condemnation of the use of chemical weapons by anyone and at any time and at any place and under any circumstances. The Tasnim News Agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. Iran's ambassador to the United Nations has blasted the UN Security Council for holding meetings on Syria's chemical weapons file repeatedly, despite the country's full cooperation with the world body, saying that such a trend may prove the political nature of such meetings. Addressing the recent UN Security Council meeting titled "The Situation in West Asia," Amir Saeed Irabani, Iran's ambassador to the United Nations, renewed the call for any investigation into the use of chemical weapons, saying that such investigation must be impartial, professional, credible, and objective, and in full compliance with the Chemical Weapons Convention, the CWC. Irabani said while the Syrian Arab Republic has met the requirements of the convention and continues to cooperate constructively with the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW, handling this file in a political and double-standard manner will only divert discussions away from their technical nature. The Iranian diplomat stressed the politicization of the provisions of the Chemical Weapons Convention, the CWC, and the exploitation of the OPCW for political purposes threatened the credibility of the organization and the Chemical Weapons Convention. Underlining that Syria voluntarily acceded to the Chemical Weapons Convention, the CWC, in 2013, Amir Saeed Irabani said, "We believe that the collaboration of the Syrian Arab Republic with the OPCW should be recognized." Bassam Sabak, Syria's permanent representative to the United Nations, said back in March that the United States was seeking to discredit his country and exert political pressure on Damascus by manipulating reports compiled by the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, OPCW. Reiterating his country's vehement opposition to the use of chemical weapons under any circumstances, Bassam Sabah told the UN Security Council meeting in New York that serious flaws in the OPCW fact-finding mission's report on Syria had tarnished the image of the international body. He emphasized Damascus's consistent cooperation with the OPCW aimed at closing the file once and for all, and called on all member states to deal with the issue professionally and impartially and not to jump to preconceived conclusions. Syria gave up all of its chemical weapons in 2013 and joined the Chemical Weapons Convention after a sarin attack in the southwestern town of Ghouta left dozens of individuals dead. Western countries claimed the attack was carried out by the Syrian government, but it placed the blame on foreign-backed terrorist groups. In 2014, a report of an investigation by journalist Seymour Hersh confirmed that Takfiri terrorists' possession of chemical weapons at the time.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Within the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Brother Muhammad and Sheikh Rouhani. Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum, welcome to you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Brother Muhammad, assalamu alaikum to you.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So, 3 years ago, we missed one of the great dignitaries of Islamic Republic of Iran, General Qasem Soleimani. He was assassinated, and it was vividly clear that the U.S. we can say administration did it, and it was by the direct order of the then president on that time. Unfortunately, we missed it, and this is again another sign of the global arrogance shown by the U.S. to the Islamic Republic of Iran. Today, we want to talk about the comprehensive personality and character of General Qasem Soleimani. When he's talking, you know, giving lectures and the sermons here and there, there are so many ayahs of the Quran, ahadith, and as our brother said, it is as if a spiritual trainer or a wayfarer is talking to you, referring to, for example, mystical poems of the Persian language or the Arabic ahadith and the ayahs of the Quran. Makes him very much different, you know, from the other military, as we said, generals all around the world. Okay, so he called himself a true student of the school of thought of the late Imam Khomeini and the leader, you know. How about this, Sheikh Rouhani?
Yes, of course. You know, Imam Khomeini himself also, when he started this revolution, it was also a very good example of fulfilling justice.
Very good.
Because he fought against the oppressor, the king, Reza Khan, Muhammad Reza.
Yes.
And, you know, one of the really, really important characteristics of this kind of people like Imam Khomeini or Sheikh Soleimani is this, that we should know that for this kind of people, martyrdom is a kind of winning. It's a kind of victory.
Yes.
While, for example, if you look at the other armies, for example, when there was war in Afghanistan and
Vietnam,
Iraq,
for example,
in Vietnam, when the American and the U.S. Army soldiers and commanders, when they were commemorating or celebrating the dead bodies or the funerals of their dead bodies, they were just saying, "Yeah, we are proud of you because of our own nation, our own people.
We are patriots because of our flag."
But when it comes to this kind of martyrs,
you know,
first of all, these martyrs themselves, they think that they will get more closer and closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Very good.
By the martyrdom.
Yes.
So they not only lose anything, but also they achieve the unlimited.
This is the way to salvation.
Infinite, infinite kind of happiness, prosperity, pleasures. So first of all, for themselves, shahada is a step forward towards the Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yes.
So this is a great achievement. It's not even comparable with what we can achieve in this earthly life.
Yes.
This is the first point. And for the other people also regret that why they were not that shaheed.
Again,
this is also
again, this
has
become martyred
in
the defensive form.
Yeah,
and we have to differentiate from the ISIS members.
Yeah,
who
the aggressive war is different. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Suicide bombing. For in order to reach to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. These two concepts are really different.
Exactly, that makes a big difference between these two kinds of.
Unfortunately, so many people all across the world cannot differentiate between these istishhadi and intihadi.
You
know, these suicide bombing and the martyrdom are really different
of course.
Because in one of them, you attack and you kill poor people all around in order to reach to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. In the other format, you are defending yourself.
Yeah, of course,
you are defending your rights.
You know, this is.
But you do not fear martyrdom in the way of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yeah, we have. We have the misunderstanding of Islam always, that we have Amawid Islam in the history, according to which when Yazid, for example, attacked in Karbala Imam Hussein and his household, the household of the Prophet, they even killed or sometimes said beheaded a kid, a child, a six-month-old child. You know, this is the Amawid Islam. But against this, we have Husseini or Alawi or the true Ahle Bayt Islam.
Really, really nice comparison.
Yeah, that's why we have responsibility to save the innocent civilians,
yes.
To save the children, to save the old men and women,
yes.
The ordinary people, and even in the battlefield. But according to the Amawid Islam, which ISIS or Daesh is also the product of this Islam,
yes.
In the history. So that's why their understanding, their idea about Islam might be different.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, of course, we should differentiate between these two different schools of thought.
And I think at the end of the day, the people can understand after the Shahada of Shahid Qasim Soleimani, who is right, who is wrong.
Yep, exactly.
Because the people could see that they are losing now their heroes in the region, a person who was, we can say standing and struggling against this, as you said, Salafi extremist behaviors in the region, who is only killing,
yeah.
Suicide bombing here and there, and how this great personality was missed. Okay, what else, Brother Muhammad?
I think if we look at the way Shahid Qasim was admitted into the army,
mm-hmm.
and then was brought up and went,
yes.
through this training, it's very important we understand that we take a look at the system,
mm-hmm.
at how this thing works,
yes.
how this Islamic Republic came into existence,
mm-hmm.
and what were the motives, what were the objectives, and what led this Islamic Republic to eventually give birth to a person like Shahid Haj Qasim Soleimani.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see many systems came about, and many countries, secular countries, they have militaries, but like you mentioned, they're,
yes.
completely different from ours.
Yes,
the system that Imam Khomeini reinitiated from the teachings of the Noble Prophet was that a person comes into the military from the motives of saving others, from defending his country, defending his people,
mm-hmm.
and then paving the ways for the zuhur of the appointed one.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So this system itself, it's very clear that a person like Shahid Qasim will definitely come through the system.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not only, and when we talk about Shahid Qasim, like we mentioned in the beginning of the program as well, we're not specifically talking about himself, we're talking about his school of thought.
Yes.
Because Sulaimani was martyred, but Sulaimanis,
yes.
are in the way.
Yes.
They're in queue to be martyred.
Okay.
Right.
And there's a greater school Sulaimani was a member of, which, you know.
Exactly.
And
that's
okay.
the system that,
yes,
we're,
yes.
in right now.
Okay.
That's the system we're in. That's the factory that creates the saviors,
mm-hmm.
of mankind.
His behaviors, even in the sociopolitical, we can say, affairs of Islamic Republic of Iran, were really exemplary. So many speeches, so many, you know, lectures of the late Shahid Soleimani regarding, for example, the concept of hijab, for example, the concept of politics, the concept of social justice,
yeah.
how this generation gap must be observed, how the gap between the rich and the poor should be solved. You know, all in all, we could see that he was really a role model for so many people, so many young generation. You know, he was, I think, more than 50 years old, but
yeah.
still the young people in the 20s and the 30s were attracted to this character, something which is missed really between, for example, the military generals of the,
yeah.
world and the population, I mean the public,
yeah.
of the people. That's all right. Sincerity and ikhlas was one of the other attributes of this outstanding man, Sheikh Rouhani, isn't it?
Yeah, of course,
so
why not?
And how we could,
yes.
understand that this ikhlas, I mean, from what?
You know, I think the generals like Shahid Soleimani, late Shahid Soleimani, rahimahullah,
yes.
You know, the point is that in this very much difficult and complicated situation in this war against ISIS in Iraq and Syria,
yes.
yeah?
Yes.
We see that it was really difficult to defend the people against Daesh.
Yes.
Against ISIS.
Yes.
Because they were like ordinary people, like normal,
yes.
people, and entered any city, any places, any gatherings, and killed innocent civilians. And it,
yes.
was really difficult to identify.
And just look at the vast wilderness,
yeah,
of Iraq and Syria.
And also they,
yes.
were supported by,
yes.
great global powers.
Yes.
You know, they were facilitated,
yes.
and the most, let's
by
say,
the Salafis,
modern,
by
yeah,
Muslims,
advanced,
yes.
let's say, technology of war.
Yes.
And it became really difficult to let's say fight against them.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was the ikhlas, it was the sincerity of these kind of people to finally find out the solution to this problem.
Yes,
it was a kind of blessings of Allah Subhanahu wa Taala upon them,
mm-hmm.
to find out how to defend these people, how to conquer, how to win, for example, this war against ISIS. Yes. So I think what makes Shahid Soleimani as an outstanding kind of, let's say, general, is this, that in this kind of difficult and problematic and, let's say, complicated war, he finally find out the good methods or ways of fighting, finding out the good ways to defend the innocent civilians, to defend Iraqi people and Syrian people against Daesh. This is the point that we should understand about Shahid Soleimani, because, yeah, many people might claim that they want to fight against, for example, Daesh, against ISIS, but the point is to find how to fight, find out the method, find out the techniques of war. This is important.
Yes.
That's why Shahid Soleimani and the people who supported him, like other, let's say, soldiers and generals, they were like outstanding people, because they find out those, let's say, suitable and proper techniques, tools, equipments, methods, and ways to fight against Daesh and conquer this war. And I think this is very much important.
And in this, we can say Jabhatul Haq against Jabhatul Batil. In the Jabhatul Haq, so many people from the other countries were attending, and they were attracted to the character of Shahid Soleimani, the people from Afghanistan, from Iraq, from, we can say, Pakistan, Fateh Biyun, Zainabiyun, okay? And so many other groups were attending, and they were attracted, you know, just one speech, for example, in the front, that will give them spiritual energy in order to continue the war against it. I think that the Western powers, after the martyrdom of Shahid Soleimani, they could understood how wrong they were in supporting, the Salafi extremist group, and how they could find the school of thought of Shahid Qasem Soleimani so, we can say, beautiful, we can say, so much friendly and kind to the world. This is, I think, at least in words they are looking for, freedom, and we can say that's right, justice for all.
Yeah, they're really respectful about that.
Okay, Brother Muhammad, we got about 1 minute, and we are done.
With regards to the sincerity, I must point out one of my encounters with one of my friends. When Shahid Qasim was martyred, I was surprised. It was, you know, it was a very surprising attack, right?
Yes.
And then I met this friend and I told him, I said, who is Shahid Qasim? He asked me, who is Shahid Qasim? That's the point I realized he was really sincere.
Yes.
Because if this guy was not sincere, then all the conquerors he had, all the victories he had would have been bolded, would have been brought in TV, would have been advertised as much as he can, because he had all the power. He was a military general. But he kept it to himself. And if you look at all his speeches, either it was... if he would brag, instead of saying brag, I'd rather say if he would give lesson about his encounters in the battlefield, it would be for the lesson for the others, not to brag about it or not to show off. You will find him sometimes crying, talking about how he saw the mercy of his mother Fatima in the battlefield.
Yes.
Right. And this shows the sincerity of Shahid Qasim in the battlefield and otherwise.
That's all right. According to his last will and testament, he was buried beside the other soldiers in a, we can say, cemetery in Kerman.
There is no shrine or mausoleum for him. It's a simple grave.
Very much reminded me of what Shahid Zainuddin said, that bury me beside the other soldiers who were martyred without any mausoleum, without any shrine or dome or something like that.
In his will, he also emphasized that they put soldier in his grave, not
Sarbaz.
A general or colonel or anything.
That's all right. Thank you very much, Brother Muhammad and Sheikh Rouhani. Nice elaboration regarding the personality of Shahid Qasem Soleimani. May Allah bless the soul of this outstanding way, and the hard extreme revenge is underway for those assassinators of this outstanding general all across the world. Thank you very much. It was very kind of you. Thank you much. Thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints. For more information, visit our website, parstoday.com/en/call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
shining bright, you came to us with a heart so full of love, and you showed that you're the one who cares the most, and to us you've always been so close. Everyone will say, please save me, accept al-Habib. Ummati, Ummati, يقولها لنا يوم القيامة. Ummati, Ummati, يقولها شفاعة أنا لها.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Two years ago, the United States, Britain, and NATO forces withdrew from Afghanistan after two decades of war and occupation of the country. Recently, in Britain, Prince Harry's confession of killing 25 people while serving in the British Army in Afghanistan has garnered attention. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Daily Telegraph has covered this story and tells us more. According to the UK media, quoting a soon-to-be-published autobiography, Prince Harry has acknowledged killing 25 people in Afghanistan during his time as an Apache helicopter pilot. Harry, the Duke of Sussex, served in Afghanistan first as a forward air controller in air raids from 2007 through to 2008. Then he flew the attack helicopter, the Apache, between 2012 and 2013. The 38-year-old is due to release a book, Spare, over the next few days, in which he reveals that he undertook six missions as pilot that led to him taking human lives. Harry said he was neither proud nor ashamed of doing so. He also described eliminating the targets as like removing chess pieces from a chessboard. He wrote, "My number is 25. It's not a number that fills me with satisfaction, but nor does it embarrass me. Video cameras mounted on the nose of his Apache attack helicopter enabled him to assess his missions and determine with certainty just how many he had killed. The prince explained his justification for his actions because of the suspicious 9/11 attacks in the United States and meeting families of the victims. He claimed those responsible and their sympathizers were enemies of humanity, and fighting them was an act of vengeance for a crime against humanity. The U.S.-led foreign forces withdrew from Afghanistan in August of 2021 after 20 years of military occupation that left tens of thousands of Afghans dead, many of them civilians. In the already controversial book to be published on 10th of January, Harry talks for the first time about the number of Taliban fighters that he killed during his service in Afghanistan. According to The Guardian, which obtained a copy of Harry's memoir, the prince has also claimed his elder brother and heir to the throne, Prince William, knocked him to the floor during a 2019 argument about Harry's wife, Meghan. Harry also disclosed that the brothers, the sons of King Charles III, had begged their father not to marry his second wife, Camilla, now Queen Consort, and that he had taken cocaine as a teenager. He served in the British Army for 10 years, rising to the rank of captain, and has described his time in the military as his favorite years. The US-led foreign forces invaded Afghanistan in 2001 with a claim of confronting Al-Qaeda. The military campaign killed at least 70,000 Afghan and Pakistani civilians, leaving Afghanistan in a state of turmoil ever since. There have been security concerns because of Harry's military service, which are likely to increase after he revealed the number of people that he has killed in Afghanistan. Website Forces News has also covered the same story and tells us more. Prince Harry's confessions of murder in Afghanistan have been met with a backlash from the media, commentators, army veterans, and even the Taliban, while Buckingham Palace has kept silent on its widely leaked contents. Revelations in his newly published memoir, in his newly published book, Spare, including the murder of 25 Taliban soldiers while serving with the British Army in Afghanistan, have prompted both condemnation and derision from various groups. Retired Colonel Tim Collins, who led a British battalion in Iraq in 2003, condemned Prince Harry's revelation and depicted it as a tragic money-making scam, saying that the prince's kill count talk was crass and we don't do notches on the rifle butt. Retired Colonel Tim Collins added, having trashed his birth family, Harry has now turned against the other family, the military, that once embraced him. Colonel Tim Collins also noted that publishing a headcount is violating an unspoken code and could jeopardize security for the British forces as well as the prince himself. Other critics said Harry had appeared wrongly to dehumanize the insurgents by describing them as chess pieces removed from a chessboard, while the Taliban charged the prince with committing war crimes during his military tour of Afghanistan. A senior Taliban leader, Anas Haqqani, tweeted, "The ones you killed were not chess pieces, they were humans. They had families who were waiting for their return. Among the killers of Afghans, not many like you, to purportedly reveal their conscience and confess to their war crimes." Abdul Qahar Balkhi, the spokesperson for the Taliban-led Afghan Foreign Affairs Ministry, also criticized the British prince's comments. Balkhi said, "The Western occupation of Afghanistan is truly an odious moment in human history, and comments by Prince Harry is a microcosm of the trauma experienced by Afghans at the hand of occupation forces who murdered innocent Afghans without any accountability." Meanwhile, Britain's Sun newspaper wrote that the Duke of Sussex has chosen a destructive, vengeful path while throwing his own family under a bus for millions of dollars. Michael Cole, a leading royal expert, also blasted Prince Harry's confession, saying that his autobiography is the most sensational royal revelations in almost 30 years and will shake the foundation of Britain's royal family. The book is the latest broadside from Harry and his American wife, Meghan Markle, after they controversially quit royal duties and moved to California in 2020. Reuters news agency has also covered the same story. Britain's military has announced it would launch an inquiry into reports that its special forces carried out dozens of extrajudicial killings in Afghanistan. Recently, Britain's Defence Secretary Andrew Morrison said in the House of Commons that Britain's Ministry of Defence, the MOD, would concede to long-standing demands for an independent statutory inquiry. The BBC reported earlier this year that British Elite Special Air Service, or SAS, forces killed Afghan civilians in cold blood. Defence Secretary Andrew Morrison said the Afghanistan inquiry, which is to start in early 2023, will focus on unlawful killings by the British Special Forces, the SAS, during deliberate detention operations in Afghanistan from mid-2010 to mid-2013. It will also examine the adequacy of subsequent investigations by the Ministry of Defence into charges of wrongdoing, including murder. The announcement follows reports that 54 Afghans were killed in suspicious circumstances by one SAS unit in Helmand province in Afghanistan between 2010 and 2011, and charges that this amounted to war crimes. Tessa Gregory from the UK law firm, which is representing the families of the deceased, said an inquiry should have been launched many years ago. Gregory said the charges of extrajudicial killings and cover-up are of such gravity and the concerns expressed contemporaneously within the British and Afghan army and by a reputable international organization working on the ground in Afghanistan were so serious and so widespread that an inquiry should have been instituted by the government many years ago. The families of eight people, including three young boys reportedly murdered by British Special Forces, the SAS, in two separate operations during night raids in Afghanistan in 2011 and 2012, welcomed the inquiry, saying they have waited for this inquiry for more than 10 years.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.